You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live all around the planet. It's the day before Thanksgiving. What are you thankful for? I got to tell you about Agenda 21 in a minute. I'm actually thankful for Agenda 21, although Glenn Beck wants to scare the bejesus out of you about it. I'll tell you about that in just a second. I'm thankful that Louise made it through her breast cancer diagnosis with clear margins and nodes and made it through her chemo and survived it, and her hair is getting fuzzy and she's getting back to normal again. I'm grateful that I made it through my surgery, and even though it got screwed up and had to, well, we don't want to go through all that. In any case, that I survived it and that I'm still here and feeling better than ever. I'm grateful that our kids are doing well, although I'm prayerful that the partner of one of our daughters is right now in Chicago for clinical trials on a leukemia drug because he didn't respond to the initial chemotherapy. This is really serious stuff. And your prayers for Jeff would be appreciated. I'm thankful for the people who work on this show, for Shano and Danielle and Jim and Sue and all the folks in the chat room and Nigel. Nigel, by the way, a week or so ago, I keep meaning to mention this. I caught it after I was off the air. I was talking about Higgins, and Nigel reminded me that who I'm thankful for, my crazy cat Higgins. That when Nigel was here visiting us a year or two ago, when we lived in Portland, I guess it must have been 2-3 years ago, that he sat down on the couch and Higgins jumped up and sat on his lap. And, you know, so, you know, Nigel's comment was, Higgins likes webmasters, apparently. I think he likes Nigel. Nigel's a wonderful guy. I'm thankful for Jamie Holly, who helps us with our web as well, and Jay Goodman Tamboli. There are so many people. So many things. And the reason why I think now, you know, without getting maudlin about this, but really just practical psychology here for a moment. I am convinced, having worked in and around the psychotherapy field for years and the education field, that the most powerful healing, mentally healing, emotionally healing force that is out there is forgiveness. And that the mirror image of that, not the opposite of that, but like the hand in hand with forgiveness is thankfulness. My prayers always begin with thank you. And I just can't imagine having a day go by where I don't wake up and say thank you for this day, no matter how bad I'm feeling. It's another day I'm alive. I mean, I think about my mom or dad, who are both, you know, buried up in Charlevoix, Michigan, and I think what either one of them would give to just sit up and look out at the sky for 1 minute. Or all the people who have preceded us. What would they give for just 1 minute of seeing this world? What an incredible, precious gift we have. I'm thankful for this platform, for this radio show. I'm thankful to all the people who carry it, the people at Pacifica who syndicate it, the people at Dow Global who syndicate it, the people at Free Speech TV who carry us, people on Sirius XM, people with the American Forces Radio. It goes on and on. I'm really grateful. So, you know, if you want to speak to that, you're welcome to give us a shout and tell us what you're grateful for. Meanwhile, Glenn Beck wants us to be scared to death. Now, I said earlier I was grateful about Agenda 21. Agenda 21 is something that originated, you know, when the UN gets together for these meetings, they will have what are called agendas, you know, agenda items. And if you've ever been to a conference, usually they're called breakout sessions, you know. Here's the breakout session on this topic. The UN being rather bureaucratic, they number things. And this was the 21st breakout session or item or whatever, agenda item. At one of the, I think it was one of the earlier UN meetings back under George Herbert Walker Bush, and then it got, you know, redone, re-ratified, re-amplified during the Rio summit, which I believe was a year or two ago. And I'm looking at UN.org at the Agenda 21 homepage. It's the UN Economic and Social Development Division for Sustainable Development. And Agenda 21, according to this, is about, I mean, literally, I'm reading from their webpage about combating poverty. Uh-oh. That right off the bat, every billionaire in America is going, what? You mean tax me more? Combating poverty, changing consumption patterns. What? You want to tax carbon? Demographic dynamics and sustainability. Sustainability? Oh, it's those hippie city planners. Protecting and promoting human health conditions. Liberals who want you to feel good. They want you to be healthy. That's terrible. Promoting sustainable human settlement development. In other words, creating cities that actually work where, you know, things like what's called mixed-use development where you can walk to the dry cleaners and to the clothing store and to the food store, and you don't need to buy a car. You don't need to even own a car. I live in a city like that here in Washington, D.C., where Louise and I live, down in the marina. Within three blocks, we can walk to a Safeway. We can walk to a pharmacy. We can walk to the cleaners. We can hop on the subway, and we can go to any store virtually in the city, any restaurant. That's a sustainable human development. I haven't owned a car in 2 years. It's the first time since I was 16 years old. I haven't owned a car. Now, granted, the first 7 or 8 years that I owned cars, I was very proud of the fact that I never paid more than $35 for one of them, and I never failed to sell them for less than $50. And very often things like the brakes didn't work. Louise, when we were early on dating, I had this old Nash Rambler that you'd have to pump the brakes 5 or 6 times before the master cylinder would get enough pressure to actually slow the car down. So I used the handbrake to slow down. And the radiator was constantly leaking, so I always had about a dozen gallon milk jugs in the back filled with water to run around and pour in the radiator. But it worked. You know, it got us through. Got us through our courting and into our early marriage years. Agenda 21, promoting sustainable human settlement development and integrating environment and development decision-making, like they do in Portland, you know, where they've got greenways and green belts. Glenn Beck has decided that this agenda, that Agenda 21, that this thing is the new way that the UN is going to destroy your life. Or at least he's written a novel, or he bought a novel from another writer or whatever. I don't know. There's all kinds of buzz about that. But in any case, he's got this new novel out, and the trailers for it, yes, he's made trailers for it. They actually show an old guy being strapped to a gurney and fed into an open fire. Yeah, he lived a good life. Now it's time to go. Well, there's nothing about that in Agenda 21. But Sarah Palin's death panels live on in Glenn Beck's fevered mind. I just find the whole thing astounding. It's like when all you have to sell is fear, which is all the right wing has to sell. You know, fear of brown people wasn't enough. Fear of gay people wasn't enough. Now they're back to the old reliable. Fear of the UN. Somebody needs to call up the right wing and tell them if they want to be afraid of somebody, they should be afraid of the World Trade Organization.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
They should be afraid of the big transnational corporations that actually do want to conquer the world and destroy American sovereignty. Oh, yeah, those guys are giving them a lot of money, aren't they?
Tom Hartman.
As God is my witness, I thought turkeys could fly.
You know, actually, last time Louise and I were at my brother Steve's house, Steve is my brother who has the guns. And we were at Steve and Tammy's house out in the countryside up near Grand Rapids. and because they got this, you know, their shooting area out in the back, and a flock of wild turkeys came by, and they were flying, but they're not, you know, all bloated like these things that we eat for Thanksgiving. So, anyhow, Glenn Beck telling us, be afraid, be very afraid. I think increasingly Americans aren't buying it. I really think that the whole John Birch Society thing, the whole, you know, the Koch brothers thing, all this, you know, be afraid. Oh, my God, it's a black president. Oh, my God, it's, a, you know, all this hysteria. Oh, you know, brown people are coming. You know, immigrants are illegally voting. Black people want to do voter. People aren't buying this stuff. White people aren't buying this stuff. Nobody's buying this stuff. Except, you know, a few crazies. Maybe 2-3%. But they're heavily embedded in the conservative entertainment complex, a very, very profitable industry that survives by selling fear and paranoia. It's really rather tragic for America. But, you know, somebody needs to tell these guys to take their tinfoil hats off. Anyhow, tomorrow's Thanksgiving. What are you thankful for? Vivian in Tuskegee Institute, Alabama. What are you thankful for, Vivian?
I think that we should be thankful that Obama is back in and that he care about people to the point that he's going to do something to help us. While O'Reilly's on TV hollering that we're getting stuff, he doesn't have any idea that they get more stuff as the white Republicans that rip us off with predatory lending and that have taken our they've taken the pension funds from the people that work when they did Enron. They sent the jobs overseas, and then they sit back and wonder why nobody put them back in office.
Yeah.
You don't have to say anything to them. Just pull the lever and let them know that what they're trying to do won't work anymore.
Yeah, I would love to hear Bill O'Reilly come out and say, you know, I so believe in what I'm saying that I've decided I'm not going to take any gifts from government. This year I'm taking no tax deductions. I'm just going to pay all of, you know, I'm going to play the flat rate, and I'm not going to take any tax deductions. I'm not going to take any gifts that have been put in there by lobbyists for rich people. I guarantee you, Vivian, he won't do it. But thank you for the call. Excellent. Very well said. Karen, what are you in Snohomish, Washington, what are you thankful for?
I am thankful for Lord Jesus, my Savior. I'm thankful for my family. And I'm thankful and very proud that my husband is in a great union. I have just a little story. There was a ship that pulled into Oregon, and the local down there, when they got on board, these poor crewmen were starving. They were eating seaweed. And it was a Greek ship, and it was so heavily in debt that he couldn't, the owner could not, you know, keep putting debt onto it. So they went and buying food or anything for these people. But our local got together and we gave them all kinds of food. And, you know, the unions give a lot.
Yeah.
And they wanted, you know, vilify unions while the capitalist is starving the people. We came and fed them.
That is
we
great.
Took care of them. We got their back pay for them, you know, through all the right channels. And I'm very proud of that.
Yeah. Well, that is great. Karen, thank you for sharing that story. I'm thankful for you, Karen. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Have a good one, Tom.
Thanks, you too. Chuck in Kalkaska, Michigan, you had some thoughts on Agenda 21?
Yeah, Tom, I'm sure you're familiar with Kalkaska.
I am.
Here a couple months ago, we had a meeting in the town of Kalkaska sponsored by the Kalkaska County Tea Party Patriots. I hadn't heard of Agenda 21, but we have a state legislator here who was a former newscaster in Traverse City, weatherman, I should say, but anyway, has introduced legislation in the Michigan legislature to basically prohibit any state funds from being used on anything that could be conceivably related to Agenda 21. And they're also very fearful that somehow Agenda 21 is going to take people's property rights away.
Yeah.
And there's a legal maneuver that they were selling that you could somehow protect your property from eminent domain seizure And I didn't stay for the whole thing. After about an hour, I could feel my brain shrinking. So I left, but I just thought, here's a, you know, state legislature has fallen for this Glenn Beck thing.
Yeah.
And thinks it's necessary to put a bill in the Michigan legislature to counter it.
Yeah, well, I thought it was really interesting that over the last month or two, there's been all this hype about Agenda 21, this obscure UN, basically, you know, a working group recommendations for communities that are doing sustainable development. And I couldn't figure out why the hysteria. Why are these guys? And then, you know, today Glenn Beck releases the novel. Of course, this is all hype to help Glenn Beck make more millions of dollars. You know, this is a multimillionaire getting rich off selling paranoia and fear, and he's got some more for you. It's really tragic. Thanks a lot for the call, Chuck. That's amazing. Noah in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Noah, what are you thankful for?
Hi, Tom. I'm thankful for my wife, my loving wife, my two boys. I'm thankful for my Medicare, which saved my life during an appendectomy procedure. I'm thankful for the Social Security disability that I'm on that keeps my wife and I out of poverty, even though technically I'm part of the 2-3% who some people think game the system and are capable of working but choose not to. I don't believe that, but I'm thankful for my Social Security disability so my wife and I stay out of poverty.
Okay. Noah, I'm thankful for you. Thank you very much for calling. And to all of you, we'll pick up more of your calls, and I'll share a little more of the news of the day with you and my take on it right after this, 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And don't forget, we have a free Tom Hartman app in the App Store. And if you go to TomHartman.com, click Community right up at the top, and you'll find an amazing place. Our crazy alert for the day. I think the headline kind of says it all. Cannibal cop will not be enjoying any girl meat this Thanksgiving. An alleged aspiring cannibal, a police officer, New York City police officer by the name of Gilberto Valle, wanted to get out on bail for Thanksgiving. Why? Because he had shared with a friend of his that he was going to get some good girl meat to eat, to cook, and eat for Thanksgiving. Yeah. The judge said his conduct has been depraved, bizarre, aberrational, and totally unexplained, and said, particularly someone who is a law enforcement officer. Yes, that's a quote. So instead of dining on dead young women, he is going to be dining on prison food instead. You think? Incredible. Really incredible. One other thing I wanted to bring up, by the way, before we just kind of get back into your phone calls and is in the New York Times today, there's a headline, "Where Pilgrims Landed, Thanksgiving is Kept at the Table, Not the Mall." And the point of this story is that, you know, since the first Thanksgiving in 1621, probably from then, because the early pilgrims were actually right-wing religious fanatics. They were the old Cromwell followers, the old, you know, you can't dance. The pilgrims were as severe as it gets. The pilgrims would look down on Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson and say, those guys are libertines. And so the pilgrims passed laws that said that it's against the law to open your doors. It probably wasn't the pilgrims. It was long after the pilgrims. But the heirs to the pilgrims, the somewhat more modern day pilgrims. Many of these passed in the late 18th, early 19th, throughout the 19th, some cases in the 20th century. What are referred to as blue laws. Nobody's sure why, whether they were issued on blue paper or what. Nobody knows. But the blue laws that said that you can't open your store on the fourth Thursday of November, on Thanksgiving Day. Can't do it. And this is the law in three states, if I have this correct. Massachusetts, Maine, and Rhode Island. And even Walmart's not going to open in Maine until just after midnight Friday, or in Massachusetts or Rhode Island until 1 a.m. Why? Because of these blue laws. Back in the 80s, when Louise and I lived in Germany, there were federal laws in Germany that said that stores could not be open on Saturday or Sunday. Those were, at least on, in particular on Sunday, most stores were closed on Saturday too. They were days for people to take off, to relax, to enjoy, but particularly on Sunday. On Sunday, the only place you could go to buy anything outside of a restaurant or a bar was a gas station. And the gas stations had, like, little mini-marts associated with them. So if, you know, somebody needed a quart of milk really quick, they'd run over to the gas station. But that was it. And I remember how nice it was living there, living in Germany. And on Sundays, you just go out and you go walking. Everybody would go walking. People would carry their walking sticks or their best walking shoes. I mean, by best, I mean most comfortable. And it was a social time. The forest was actually filled with people because they maintain trails through the forest. They actually have signs on them that tell you where you're going, all through the forest, all over Germany. Because it's like, it's just something everybody does. They go out in nature. Now, over the 30 years or so since we lived there, it's been that long, almost 30. It'll be 25 years anyway. Germany has largely done away with those laws, and stores are starting to open on Sundays, and they're getting modern. But I look back on that, and this is not like looking back on your childhood wistfully. I mean, I was in my 20s and 30s at the time. And I look back on that, or on my 20s anyway, I look back on that, and I think, you know, that was really cool. Well, in the 80s, I was in my 30s. Anyhow, that was really a nice time. Kids played outdoors. Everybody, people knew each other. People got together. There was nothing else to do. So I asked the question, and I'm gonna debate this tonight with a couple of conservatives on TV, but I just, you know, I ask you, should we consider having some blue laws like this that say that you can't engage in retail business on Thanksgiving? Or even on Sundays. Or pick some other day. I mean, you know, Sunday is the Christian Sabbath, Saturday the Jewish Sabbath, Friday the Muslim Sabbath. Pick one. Or pick all three. Or two out of the three. I mean, flip a coin. I don't care how. I think that the injunction in the Ten Commandments that every seventh day you're just going to hang out and do nothing is good for our mental and physical and spiritual health. And I think periodically not being able to go to the store because the stores are all closed is good for us. Now, I realize this probably throws me into the category from right-wing standards of, oh, my God, he's a nanny state guy. He wants the government to close down businesses. Yes. But let me remind you, it was the most conservative among us who put those laws into place in the first place. So what are you thankful for? Are you afraid of Agenda 21? And do you think that we should have blue laws in the United States that say, at least on Thanksgiving? You know, it's a secular holiday. It's not like Christmas, which is a religious holiday. Thanksgiving is a secular holiday. It's just a day that we all get together and celebrate family and country and community. And sharing. It comes out of the potlatch tradition of the Indians. The potlatch tribes. And I'm sorry, I don't remember the name of the tribe that did the first Thanksgiving. It was long ago and far away. But most of these tribes were what are referred to by anthropologists as potlatch communities. In a potlatch community, you gain status by giving things away. And so if, you know, the Native Americans were working with the Europeans to help them survive on this little plot of land there, and they wanted to impress them, they wanted to share with them, they wanted to gain status with them, so what do? They gave away their food. So we have this potlatch day. I mean, this is a remnant. This is a vestigial piece of some highly functional ancient communities. The ones out of the Bible, the old Jewish communities, and it wasn't unique to the Jews. I mean, many different indigenous Aboriginal post-agricultural, early modern tribes had these same things of jubilee, of seventh year, leave the fields fallow, of every seventh day is a day of rest. They had that and this annual holiday that is like, hey, it's our national day of rest. Should we go back to blue laws? I think you could build a good case for it. Vi in Donovan, Missouri, if I'm saying that right. Vi?
You know what I'm thankful for?
What are you thankful for?
I'm thankful for the president's reelection.
Yeah.
I agree with the first caller's thoughts about the president being reelected. And I think we ought to be thankful, too, that maybe Anonymous helped us there in Ohio with those trap doors.
Yeah, it may well be.
And whether they did or didn't,
I'm thankful that the topic is out there.
Meltdown on Fox that evening. It just all seems to fit to me, Tom. And like I said, I think maybe we ought to be thankful to Anonymous in Ohio, and hats off to those to Anonymous up there.
There you go. I'm with you, Vi. Thank you very much for the call. Ricky in Federal Way with Washington, listen, Talk 1090. Hey, Ricky, what are you thankful for?
Well, hello there, Tom. This is a first-time caller, long-time listener. Several things. First thing I want to talk about what I'm thankful for. I'm thankful for progressive radio. Sir, until 2008, when we first voted in President Obama, when I was still working, I was a salesman for 35 years, and as I was driving around, only thing I knew was what they call the conservative radio.
Right.
And they talk so ugly about the president, so disrespectfully, that I just was so frustrated, and I happened to mention my frustration in a convenience store. And the lady was walking out the door, getting ready to get her gas, and she came over to me and said, "Hey, mister, why don't you try this 1090 up in your area, and I think you'll be surprised." And true enough, I turned over there, and I've been following this station and you guys ever since. You've been a breath of fresh air.
Well, that's great.
Completely.
Thank you.
Not only for being on the left, but also giving us a mild history lesson as we go along, Mr. Hartman, and I greatly appreciate that.
Thank you, Ricky.
Living in the state of Washington on the blue laws. Man, we just got past the blue laws about 6 months ago. Well, actually, about a year ago.
Okay, so you're not a fan of the blue laws then, Ricky. I'm not in favor of all of them, you know, the whole no dancing, no drinking, all that kind of stuff. I'm not in favor of all of them. But I just wonder if we should have a national day of rest. Ricky, thanks a lot for the call. I'm thankful for you, too. I appreciate the call. We'll be back 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I'm especially thankful for my sweetie Louise. Thank you, Louise. We'll be back. So should we bring back the blue law? Should we say, sorry, on Thanksgiving you have to just hang out with the family? There's just no two ways around it. Sorry about that. Or should Black Friday become Black Thursday Friday and Thanksgiving just becomes another crazy shopping day before Christmas, which is the direction we're heading? Jim in New York City. Hey, Jim, what are your thoughts on that?
Hey, Tom, thanks for taking the call. What I'm thankful for, and it ties right in with what you're talking about, is when I was a kid, we grew up in a lower middle class suburban neighborhood outside of Chicago, and we were surrounded, there was a developing community. We were surrounded by, farmland and ponds and swamps and all these wonderful things that I got into when I was a kid.
Yep.
I didn't go to malls. I didn't play video games. I didn't do any of these things that kids now are being fed by. This these are what kids are growing on now. Mm. And you know, I developed my appreciation for life. I developed empathy for living things, you know, by what I did as a kid. And I think, yeah, shutting down malls on Sunday would be a great step towards, you know, getting kids maybe into something else other than their iPhones and other than malls and other than just becoming a good consumer.
Yeah, I am totally with you. I grew up in a lower middle class subdivision of Southern Lansing, and it's all developed around it now. But when I was a kid, those many years ago, we could walk four blocks or five blocks, my friends and I, and literally be out in the woods. And there was a little stream that went through. There was a railroad track that went through there. We used to sit down by the tracks down by that little river, and there's a big pond, and you know, poke the frogs and watch them jump and look for crayfish and
tadpoles.
Yeah, all that stuff. I mean, it was so cool. It was like, you know, nature was right there, and our parents weren't hysterical about, you know, where are they, and you know, right. We didn't have to have our cell phones with us because we didn't have them. It was like,
exactly.
it was a different time in some ways, but you know, and there were, you know, let's be honest about it. The year that Jack Kennedy was sworn in as president of the United States was the year that the population of the world hit 3 billion people. So
right.
There were half as many people on the planet when Jack Kennedy, fewer than half. But still, I think that there is some possibility that those times could be reclaimed for our kids. Jim, thanks for the call. Well said. Sarah, is it Weiser or Weezer, Idaho?
Hey, it's Weezer.
Hey, Sarah, what's up?
Sorry, can you hear me?
Just fine, thank you.
Okay. I wanted to say something about a day of rest is really a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I really, really agree with Americans just shop way too much.
Mm-hmm.
And I know this because I got married into this family, and that's all the ladies do is go shopping. And I'm like, what the heck? You know, my mom didn't teach me to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, we were always poor. So we, you know, I couldn't have a power wheel or, you know.
Yeah. So you think that a day of rest, even if it's a government mandated one, might be a good thing?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Great.
Because, I mean, it gives your body a chance to relax and get over all the work that you did throughout the week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I, you know, for decades, I took Saturdays off. I just religiously, fanatically, and I've kind of given that up in the last year or two, and I'm really noticing the loss. I need to go back to doing it. Sarah, thank you for the call, and thank you for watching Free Speech TV. Curtis in Auburn, Washington. Hey, Curtis, what's on your mind? What are you thankful
for? And the top of the morning to you, and of the rest of the day as well.
Well, thank you, sir. Thank you.
Okay, well, the day off,
mm-hmm.
That is left to interstate commerce, the power of the feds.
Right.
Okay. And the Soviet Union tried to stretch that out to 10 days.
Really?
And they were having nervous breakdowns all over the country. They had to go back to 7.
Okay.
10 is too much. Now, I was on a committee for investigating accidents,
uh-huh.
Union work.
Uh-huh.
And the guy was in an accident. Well, I mean, he made a bad cut on about a dozen parts.
Right.
Well, you talk a dozen parts at $5,000 apiece, you're talking about some money.
Yeah.
Okay, so they said he was careless, and I said, well, let's look at his pay, his the time card.
Right.
I don't mean just one; I mean go back.
Right.
And they brought him out there, and he had worked 7 days half the time, and 6 days the rest of the time for over 2 years.
So the guy wasn't taking enough time off to recharge.
And I they said, well, we expect you to support us. And I said, I don't owe you anybody's support.
Yeah.
I'm in the business for the business.
Yeah, yeah.
So do you think I'm ornery?
So, well, maybe, but you know, so you are saying that that guy should have been required to take a day off.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. No, I don't think you're ornery, Curtis. I agree with you. I totally agree with you. Thanks a lot for the call. And in fact, in a lot of European countries, you are required to take vacation. 4 weeks of vacation a year, 5 weeks of vacation a year, 6 weeks of a vacation a year, period. You have to take it. You have to pick when you're going to take it. Your employer has to provide it on a paid basis. Norway, Germany, France, Sweden, Switzerland, so many of these countries do this. Vi in Ripon, California. Hey, Vi, what are you thankful for?
Oh, Tom, I am 65 years old, and the last 3 years, I have learned more from you than I thought was ever possible, and I cannot begin to thank you. The facts I have been able to acquire, and throughout my day, I have learned that I have the ability to repeat these to people around the country in my different dealings. And these young people are completely oblivious to what is happening. And by the time we are through speaking with one another, they just tell me how appreciative they are of what I have told them. And you have made this possible.
Well, that's great, Vi. Thank you.
I mean, this is an amazing thing that you have done with your life.
Well,
I thank you, sir.
Thank you, Vi. Thank you for your kind consideration and your kind words. Not necessary, much appreciated. Thank you. We'll be back. It's Wednesday before Thanksgiving. We are going to have a conservative commentator on as we come into our second hour, but we'll also make it an Anything Goes Thursday or Wednesday.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 6 minutes past the hour. Welcome back to the second hour of our program, the day before Thanksgiving. T.J. McCormick on the line with us, conservative commentator. You can find him over at Facebook.com/TJTalks and Twitter at T.J. McCormick, McCormack. T.J., welcome back to the program.
I disagree. I mean, thank you. Thank you.
All right. Lloyd Blankfein, the CEO of Goldman Sachs, says that we need to bump up the retirement age. We need to make those bricklayers work until they're 70 instead of 65 or even 62, which you could take early retirement, because we're living so much longer now than we were in 1935. I'm assuming you know, TJ, that is by and large I'm looking for a word I can use on the media, on the air. Let's say nonsense, bullpucky, bat guano.
Malarkey? You want to take a nod from Biden? Malarkey?
Malarkey. Malarkey's a fine one. The fact of the matter is that if you live past your 10th or 15th birthday, in other words, if you take out infant mortality, because back in 1935, a lot of people didn't live past their first birthday, in large part because of sanitation problems and severe poverty in the United States. If you take, if you only look at people who are over 15 years old, you know, we're only living a year or two longer on average. And right now, if you look at people who have turned 65 and compare them to back then, the average lifespan for anybody making under $200,000 a year is 1 year longer than it was back then. And it's about 7 years longer if you're a rich person. So,
I think there's something to be said about, the fact that there are some harsh realities that we all have to face in terms of what these, and I only use the word entitlement just to talk about what we all know we're talking about. I'm not making a grand statement about people sitting back and waiting for a check.
I'm entitled to get back the money I paid into Social Security my whole life.
Exactly. And you know what? And that is something that, look, Tom, I won't say I agree with you, but I think we're both on the same page there. I've been paying into my Social Security. I want it back. However, quality of life is better as we get older these days. If we're only living 1 or 2 years longer or 3 or 4, we can get a bunch of scientists in a room and there'll be some that will say we're living 10 years longer. The quality of the life is better later on. But again, we have to.
So that means it's less expensive.
This money is just simply not going to be there. We have to change things.
Now, wait a second, TJ. I understand that Pete Peterson, a Wall Street billionaire, has spent a half a billion dollars, more than $400, almost $500 million, trying to convince largely conservatives that Social Security is broke, going broke, terrible, you know, it's a disaster. Do you, and he's lying to you, do you understand that in 82 when Reagan put together his commission, or 81 when he put together the commission with Daniel Patrick Moynihan and whoever the other guy was on there, that what they saw was that from 35 until 81, every generation had paid for their parents' retirement. But this rabbit going through the python of the baby boomer generation was coming. And, you know, how do we deal with this? And the answer that they came up with was, let's double tax the boomers. Let's have them pay not only for their parents' retirement, but for their own retirement as well. And so starting in 81, Reagan doubled the Social Security tax so that Social Security, instead of just paying out, you know, benefits, Social Security started accumulating a profit. It has $2.7 trillion sitting in that trust fund right now. That is money where the baby boomer generation double paid, the only generation in history to do that. And the theory is that Reagan put together is after the last boomers die in the 2030s, 2040s, they'll go, you know, they'll cut those Social Security tax rates and go back to just, you know, people will just be funding the retirement of their parents. But there's $2.7 trillion sitting in that trust fund, and Pete Peterson and his buddies on Wall Street want to get their hands on that so bad they're salivating so much, but it's all invested in government treasuries. And that's why they're saying Social Security is going broke. Social Security is just fine, thank you very much. It's going to pay out every benefit for the next 20 years, and after that it'll pay out 80% of benefits forever with no adjustments whatsoever. And if you simply said that Pete Peterson has to pay the same amount of the same percentage of tax in Social Security as his butler, as his driver, as his valet, and as his chef, then Social Security would be solvent forever.
Did you just say that in 20 years it's going to be paying 80% of the benefits?
Yes.
That sounds broken to me. What about we needed to pay 100% of the benefits all the way through?
I agree, and that's why I'm saying right now, your first $110,000 of income, you pay, you know, between you and your employer, you pay 8% Social Security tax on it. After that first $110,000, you take Mitt Romney, for example. Last year, he made $22 million. Of that $22 million, he paid Social Security tax on the first $110,000, and then after that, he didn't pay a penny of Social Security tax on the other $23,900,000. If he had simply paid the same percentage of Social Security tax as his chauffeur, Social Security would be solvent. And nobody's disputing that. Even Pete Peterson doesn't dispute that. So why don't you get on board with the rest of us and say, we can solve, you know, the, quote, problem with Social Security, not require anybody to be laying bricks until they're 70 years old or working in a restaurant with their knees going out until they're 70 years old.
I think because I'm hearing a lot of talk about how we can, why we should take more. Why we should and how we should improve our revenue collection and the levels of revenue to collect. But I think the other side of the discussion, I still want to hear where we're going to make very important cuts. I think that's the other side.
Social Security has nothing to do with the budget deficit. Social Security has a $2.5 trillion surplus.
We're to come to the table and talk about revenue, but we got to hear more about cuts and maybe other harsher realities like taking the benefits later.
So, Social Security has nothing to do with the budget deficit. In fact, Social Security has a $2.7 trillion surplus. So we can take Social Security out of this discussion. Now, if you want to discuss cutting other benefits,
in a frame of mind for making deals and coming to
wait a second.
You know what I'm talking about?
Wait a second. If you want to discuss cutting other benefits as a way to balance the budget, and if we're going to operate within Jude Wininsky's framework of you know, forcing the Democrats to shoot Santa Claus by going into austerity, can you please identify for me one country in history? You can go all the way back to the Greek democracy 3,000 years ago, the Roman Republic 2,000 years ago. Please identify for me one country, or for that matter, in the United States in the last 100 years, one state that has cut its way to prosperity.
Well, you know what? Maybe it hasn't come to pass that they've had to. And you might be speaking. You might actually be speaking some sense to a lot of people. I think you know it's a shame that we've gotten to the point that we've had to cut our way to profit. Because what's happened is, I can tell you that America, like a lot of other places, has spent themselves
into.
Well, here's the simple thing, TJ. It has never happened. It has never worked. What we've seen in the last 2 years is 24 red states where the governors actually cut taxes and cut spending, and they've all seen unemployment get worse, and they've seen their GDP go down. Not all of them. There's been two or three exceptions, like Ohio, because of the auto bailout. And then you've got 25 blue states where taxes were raised, revenue was raised, more money was spent, and in every case, unemployment went down, revenue and GDP went up. So it's like austerity doesn't work. The stuff that's been preached by these billionaires doesn't work.
Well, again, it's one of these things. Nobody likes the notion of austerity, really, in and of itself.
Eisenhower had tried austerity after World War II, we had 127% of GDP debt after World War II. It's far worse than it is right now. 127% of GDP. He did not cut his way to prosperity.
Exactly.
He spent like a drunken sailor. He built highways across America. He funded 80% of the cost of any hospital anywhere in the country. He paid 100% of the cost of thousands of schools. He spent money, and that money stimulated the economy. It created a middle class of taxpayers, and we paid off the debt by growing our way out of it.
Again, we may not be able to cut our way to prosperity, but we have certainly learned how to spend our way.
I think we can grow our way out of it. But TJ McCormick, Facebook TJ Talks.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Thanks, TJ, for dropping by. Nice to hear from you.
Of course. Good to talk to you.
Good talking with you.
When bad tides fall, you know it's got to be.
Black Friday? Was that what they were saying? Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah. Black Friday is coming day after tomorrow, and I'm pretty ambivalent about this whole let's go shopping on Thanksgiving thing. I suppose, you know, the online stores are not going to close for Thanksgiving Day, and enough people are addicted to their computers that, you know, they're going to get crazy anyway. But and you could argue that by forcing the physical retail stores to close, what you're doing is you're just pushing people to Amazon.com, et cetera, or to the websites, you know, Macy's.com or Target.com or whatever it may be. But and which kind of demonstrates the futility of trying to legislate anything on the one hand. But on the other hand, you know, when we had those, whether they were by blue laws or whether it was simply by community consensus. Again, I was a little kid in the 50s and 60s, and a little kid in the 50s, a teenager in the 60s, and I remember stores being closed on Sunday in Lansing, Michigan. And it wasn't because they were required to by law. It's because they just decided, hey, let's give everybody a day off. Retail stores. So what can you say? John in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, John, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I wanted to say, you know, since people were saying what they were thankful for, I'm thankful that you give ordinary people a forum in order to express their opinion. I mean, that is really rather nice, because mostly ordinary people in a very, I think this is a very elitist culture and has become more so in many ways since I've been around, that ordinary people really do not get a chance to speak and express their opinion I guess you have 3 million listeners?
Yeah, that's on the radio. We're not sure how many on television, but it's
That's a nice thing. What I wanted to say was I work in healthcare, and I'm rather concerned, and I think many caregivers, nurses, I'm a respiratory therapist, my wife's a nurse, you know, a lot of direct patient caregivers are concerned about cuts proposed in Medicare, not in the services, but actually in the reimbursement, because that translates. One article I read, even a 2% cut would translate to layoffs in healthcare, and that's been a strong sector in the economy. I mean, I'm pretty lucky. Mm-hmm. And also, I wanted to make the comment that, you know, to your conservative guest, I've worked 32 years in healthcare, of which 20 I've worked at night. Now, that was my choice because I like the direct patient care, but I'm not especially fond of administration and these kinds of things. And I found that actually the stress of working at night is less than the stress of having to deal with all of that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But in this whole, in these proposed cuts, unfortunately, the way our healthcare system is, so much is spent on administration. I mean, we have oodles of people who don't do anything with patient care and have all kinds of nifty ideas about what I should do and how I should do it. Some of it's good. I know I like my direct, my own manager. I think he's very good. But there's layers and layers of administration. And I've once read an article. This was many years ago.
John, the point you're trying to make?
Well, the point I'm trying to make is that these people who propose that we should work longer, I mean, they haven't actually worked. Working in a hospital, so we're reimbursed well.
Yeah, do we really need to be listening to the Mitt Romneys of the world, to the millionaires and billionaires, to the Lloyd Blankfeins, the guy making, 14 or 18 million bucks a year about when we should retire? John, very well said. Thank you very much. Totally with you. Gary in Chicago. Hey, Gary, what's up?
Well, I was just going to talk about the blue laws.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a seven-day event of belief for over 100 years that ecological disasters will get so numerous and so severe that Congress will mandate a Sunday rest law or a Sunday worship law.
Actually, if it's seven-day Adventist, it would be a Saturday rest law.
Well, no.
The Seventh-day Adventists believe that the seventh day is Saturday, and that's their Sabbath. That's their holy day is Saturday, not Sunday. But
yeah, I know.
Yeah,
okay. I know. So Congress will mandate a Sunday law, that's mandated that we should keep Sunday, while the Seventh-day Adventists will be persecuted for keeping Saturday.
Oh, I see.
And it's because of so much ecological disasters, numerous and severe, and so we're seeing that come true. Sandy, Irene, other global warming, issues around the world.
Right.
And so what are your thoughts about that?
Well, I don't know. I don't know about the Seventh-day Adventist prophecy. I am familiar with the Seventh-day Adventist Church. When Louise and I ran the Community for Abused Kids up in New Hampshire, hunterschool.org, salemchildrensvillage.org, the local Seventh-day Adventist Church was very enthusiastic about helping us out, in part because they saw it as an evangelism opportunity, which any church does. They gave us a bunch of books about, Seventh-day Adventism, I guess would be how you say it. But also because we were running a vegetarian program, and they're vegetarians. And I personally always took Saturdays off because my mentor, Gottfried Mueller, thought that Saturday was actually the day that you were supposed to take off. And his mentor, Avram Polyak, was a Hasidic Jew, and he convinced Herr Mueller that this is the way you should do it. And so it's, I became familiar with Seventh-day Adventists, but I don't... I don't know that much about, a prophecy of persecution coming down the road. But I think that our environmental disasters do need to be waking us up. We need to back off, take our foot off the throttle a little bit, live life a little more slowly, life a little more deliberately, and lighten our carbon footprint. We need to pay attention to the UN's Agenda 21.
You could see Saturday or the Congress, they're very, severe and not that kind of thing,
Yeah. Well, Congress always takes Saturday off and Sunday. And when the Republicans run, they take Monday and Friday off, too. It's pretty amazing. Gary, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back 27 minutes past the hour. No, seriously, when the Republicans are running Congress, they take a day a week off more than when the Democrats are running Congress. It's true.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Now, maybe that's just because, they want to be back in their districts working, or maybe it's because David Vitter needs an extra day for his business. I don't know.
Eat that turkey all night long. 50 million Elvis fans can't be wrong. Turkey lurkey do and turkey lurkey da. I eat that turkey, then I take a nap.
Is that a turkey? Is that... Oh, that's Adam Sandler singing at Thanksgiving. Okay. Thank you, Shano. Happy Thanksgiving to you and yours, to everybody. Jim in Blackwood, New Jersey. Hey, Jim.
Hi, Tom. Happy Thanksgiving to you and Louise.
Well, and thank you, and the same to you and your family.
Talking about different days off, I was up in Canada several years ago on Good Friday, and I was surprised. Up there, Good Friday's like Christmas in the States. Everything's closed up, tight as a drum. Only thing open are like gas stations, 7-Elevens.
You must have been in one of the French-Canadian, very Catholic Ontario. Regions.
No, it's Ontario, the whole country, I think.
Yeah.
But
okay.
In Toronto and Niagara Falls, the tourists, they can be open between noon and 6 p.m. It's called a statutory holiday, or stat holiday for short. And many Canadians have dinners with their family that night.
Huh. Well, the part of me that appreciates everybody getting together and saying, we're going to shut down and take it easy, says, that's really great. And the part of me that is a little bit libertarian, I suppose, says, wait a minute, the government telling me I can't do business?
I complained to a store like the Yank and me, but then he gave me some good reasons why, and I guess he was right. So also up in Bergen County, New Jersey, Paramus, up in the Garden State Parkway, they have Blue Laws on Sunday. It's the biggest shopping area between New York City and Montreal. It's kind of eerie seeing these mega malls on a Sunday with not a car in the parking lot.
Right. That's very interesting. It would be interesting to know how many people shop on Friday or Saturday instead versus how many people just go, you know, across a border to some other state.
I know in Canada, because Good Friday is a holiday, and so is Easter Sunday. But
right.
Saturday, the malls were packed to the rim up there.
Right. Interesting. Jim, thanks for sharing that with us. Jerry in Amityville, New York. Hey, Jerry, what's up?
Yeah, thanks very much for taking my call, and happy Thanksgiving to everyone. When you had your conservative guest on, I just had a call. I mean, to me, a conservative guest is a perfectly good example of why all Democrats need to draw a line in the sand and fight back instead of singing kumbaya when it comes to all these Republicans saw changes to Social Security and Medicare, such as raising the age of eligibility. I mean, not only is this a Pandora's box where the Republicans will constantly be moving the goalpost with respect to raising the age of eligibility, but the only way this saves the government money is by making sure that every year you raise the age of eligibility for Medicare or Social Security, increase the likelihood that someone will die before they ever become old enough to collect it.
Right.
In fact, Mitt Romney, in the presidential campaign before he got the nomination back in February, there was an Associated Press report about how he wanted to raise Medicare's eligibility age by 1 month per year and eventually tie the age of eligibility for Medicare to life expectancy. So does that mean somebody have to be 77 or 81 before they come? Yeah, I kid you not. It was a report by Casey Hunt that came out. It was published in my newspaper on February 25th, Romney's Medicare idea.
Amazing.
And this is why Democrats cannot be suckered into this whole nonsense of, well, let's go along with the Republicans. If we raise the age by 2 years, what's so terrible? First of all, it should be going in the opposite direction of, as you have pointed out previously, in terms of the
yes,
age.
Yes, if we lowered the Social Security retirement age to 55, you would have about half the people between 55 and 65 who are eligible. Probably about half of them would take that early retirement. The other half would keep on working because they're enjoying what they're doing. And by doing that, by having half of the people in that cohort, and that's a lot of people, by the way. This is the baby boomer generation. It's a lot of human beings. By having them retire, you open up hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of job slots for young people. You would tighten up the labor market, which would drive up wages, which would increase tax collections, which would pay off the debt and re-energize the economy, all by lowering the retirement age rather than raising it. Raising the retirement age is going to hurt the economy, and I don't know why conservatives don't get this. Jerry, you certainly do, and God bless you for it. Dave in Long Beach, California. Hey, Dave, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to mention about Black Friday that Adbusters for years has sponsored Buy Nothing Day on a Friday after Thanksgiving.
Yes.
Just wanted to throw that out there and remind you.
Yeah, Adbusters has always gotten that out and done it well. And you know, for a couple of years, they tried to buy ads on the national networks, which refused to take their ads, and that made news stories. I haven't seen anything from or about them this year. Are they still doing it?
I think they do. I think it's a standing thing every year. I haven't seen any posters yet this year.
Yeah, because their Friday is Buy Nothing Day, official Buy Nothing Day. We used to have a clip of a 30-second ad that they produced that was just absolutely brilliant about Buy Nothing Day. And, you know, maybe if we can track that down, I'll play it for you later on. Yo, you got it? Here it is. Hey, hang on just a second, Dave, and we will play for you this clip from Adbusters from years past about Buy Nothing Day. Here it is.
The average North American consumes 5 times more than a Mexican, 10 times more than a Chinese person, and 30 times more than a person from India. We are the most voracious consumers in the world. A world that could die because of the way we North Americans live. Give it a rest. November 23 is Buy Nothing Day.
Now, that year, the Friday after Thanksgiving was November 23rd. Is it this year, too? Yeah, I don't have a calendar in front of me. I'm hopeless when it comes to time, as I've said many times. So that's perfect. That ad could be running right now. And it's, by the way, it's also done as television, and it's got pictures of landfills and pigs and all kinds of, yeah, I mean, it's just brilliantly done. Pat in Newport, Oregon. Hey, Pat, what's up?
Hey, I just like to comment on back up your comment on the Social Security and raise the cutoff age from the, or not age, but the limit, raise it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was, happened to be out driving around and listened to that one caller making it sound like it's going broke, and anybody with any common sense knows it's not going broke. But hey, if we put people to work and quit stagnating wages and raise our wages up, we'd be paying more money in.
Yeah, you want to solve Social Security, either you can have Mitt Romney pay the same as everybody else pays, everybody else who makes under $110,000, which is, you know, 95% of us anyway. Or you could raise the minimum wage from $7.25 an hour up to $10.50 or $12.50 an hour, which I believe is what it would be if it was inflation adjusted to 1960. And, you know, that would generate a lot of revenue because you got a lot of people working at low wages.
Yep. And you were speaking to a gentleman there just a few minutes ago about the retirement age. Well, my father was fortunate enough to retire at 62. He was 41 years in the union, and he was lived healthy for about 4 years and got sick and passed away on his before he even turned 70. What's the limit? I'm sorry that I don't have millions of dollars in the bank, and those people don't need Social Security, but a good share of us probably do when we get there.
Yeah. Well said. Pat, thank you very much for the call, and I'm sorry for your loss, but I agree with you. And I want to say, in fact, it's a chapter in my book, Rebooting the American Dream. There's a whole chapter about the math on this. If we lowered the retirement age down to 55, we would actually stimulate the economy. It would be a good thing for America. Virginia in East Hampton, Massachusetts, listening on WHNF. Hey, Virginia, what's up?
Oh, not a whole lot, according to your radio show. I'm calling on the subject that you're talking about, raising the retirement age.
Mm-hmm.
I have a problem with that. A lot of people have a problem with that.
Yeah.
Only because I know a lot of elderly people who are stuck at jobs that they can't perform the way they used to. Also, I know that age discrimination is out there, and there aren't a whole lot of employers who are going to pay top dollar. By top dollar, I mean just enough for an old person to support themselves, to perform in functions that they can no longer perform efficiently.
You know, Paul Krugman is writing about this in his blog in the New York Times today, and or maybe it was yesterday, but I read it today in the New York Times online. And he pointed out that the age at which the largest percentage of people start new businesses, now you'd think, okay, what age would it be that most people become entrepreneurs? Is it like 20, 25, 30? At what age do people step out and become entrepreneurs? The age, the single number that has the highest percentage of brand new entrepreneurs is 65. And the reason for that is because that's the year people qualify for Medicare. That's the year that they no longer have to stay with a crummy job or an employer that they, you know, or they really don't like, but hey, they've got health insurance. And because they qualify for Medicare, they can now step out on their own. And this is why we should have universal health care, universal single payer health care. You know, just like the countries that we're competing with, like Canada and Germany, you know, where they have national single-payer healthcare programs, because it enables people to become entrepreneurs. It enables them to take risks. It enables them to step out and say, you know, I'm going to try this out. I'm going to see how it works. I may not succeed, but at least I know that if I get sick, my family won't be, you know, we won't lose the house and everything won't be gone, you know, and like that. There's some really simple lessons here, and I don't understand why conservatives don't get it. I don't understand why when I have a conservative talk show host on the program, a guy who talks about this on the radio every day, you know, for years, that he doesn't understand that if you simply had rich people pay the same into Social Security as plumbers, that Social Security would be solvent forever. problem solved. I mean, it's I, you know, it just boggles my mind. Virginia, thank you for the call, and I hope you have a wonderful Thanksgiving.
Thanks so much. You too. Bye-bye.
Thank you. My very best to you and your family. And we will be back with more. It's 45 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. Should we have blue laws that say that at least on Thanksgiving Day, you can't open your store unless it's essential services stuff, unless it's a gas station or something? Should we do that? I think so.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Call, you know, some may say I'm a dreamer. But I think we need to slow down a little and think.
Oh, there's no place like home for the holidays.
Yeah, well, it's kind of a Christmas song, but let's apply it to Thanksgiving. No, it's a Thanksgiving song too, huh? Yeah, okay, you're not going to play that at Easter, I don't think. Anyhow, let's check out the news here. This Talk Radio News Service report brought to you by the efforts to free America's newest political prisoner, former Alabama Governor Don Siegelman. You can sign the petition asking President Obama to pardon Don Siegelman at free-don.org. Be sure to check it out. And Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us. Hey, Victoria, nice to see your smiling face. What's up?
Hey, Tom. Well, Israel and Hamas agreed to a ceasefire today. About 3 hours ago, the eighth day of real hostilities, Israeli bombardment of Gaza and hundreds of rocket strikes inside Israel. After intensive negotiations in Cairo, and the United States, of course, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has been involved, as has Egyptian President Morsi. And this agreement seems to be quite interesting. The draft agreement that's been circulating says Israel shall stop all hostilities on the Gaza Strip, land, sea, and air, including incursions and targeting of individuals, and that all Palestinian factions shall stop all hostilities from the Gaza Strip against Israel, including rocket attacks and attacks along the border. Mm-hmm. Now, then it says that issues of opening border crossings and facilitating the free movement of people and goods shall be dealt with after 24 hours from the start of the ceasefire. So this first 24 hours is crucial.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. And it seems to me that because Morsi, am I pronouncing that right?
Morsi.
Morsi, thank you. The new president of Egypt, you know, he's with the Muslim Brotherhood. He's not viewed as a U.S. puppet the way that Mubarak was, or for that matter, Sadat. And so he has a lot of credibility on the Arab street and among the Palestinians. And not to mention the fact that Egypt, far and away, is the biggest, you know, population-wise, the biggest country in the Middle East.
83 million.
Yeah. And so here's a guy who, you know, may help be responsible for brokering something that would be truly extraordinary. I thought it was great, you know, when Hillary Clinton kind of peeled off from President Obama's Southeast Asia tour and went to the Middle East for this. She may pull a rabbit out of the hat here.
Well, she may. And it's really in Morsi's interest also. I mean, he won with only 51% of the vote. He needs to consolidate his win. He also needs to establish himself as a strong leader, and he wants Egypt to be seen as the strongest country in the Arab world, again, as a world leader. And by doing something like this, he can get himself on the pathway to be seen as that leader.
Yeah, if he plays it right. He's got a delicate line to walk, because he can't be seen as a stooge for the United States or Israel, and yet, on the other hand, if he doesn't work out a peace between the Palestinians and Israel, he's going to be seen as incompetent at negotiation or whatever. I mean, it's exactly.
And there are things he wants out of this as well. So this is a very, very interesting piece of diplomacy for him.
Yeah, one of the things he wants out of it is a continuation of $3 billion a year in U.S. foreign aid.
Well, exactly. And I think if the ceasefire holds, he's
going
to get on the way to getting that.
Yeah, I agree. What else is up?
On Obamacare, John Boehner, the House Speaker, has written in the Cincinnati Inquirer that President Obama's health care reform law, quote, has to stay on the table as both parties discuss ways to solve our nation's massive debt challenge. He said that over the past couple of years, he'd noted that there are essentially three major routes to repeal: the courts, the presidential election process, and the congressional oversight process, with two of those three routes having come up short. The third and final one becomes more important than ever.
Now, this sounds to me like code for we're going to refuse to fund parts of the of Obamacare or the agencies that administer it. And he actually has that power because all funding legislation by virtue of the Constitution has to originate in the House of Representatives, which he runs. Is this not a pretty naked threat, or is this John Boehner just speaking for the benefit of the Tea Party and then he's going to come out with a compromise later?
Well, that's part of it, because he talks about oversight in the House Ways and Means Committee.
Right.
So that's a piece of it. I think the other piece of it is, I think they're looking to chip away at Obamacare during the negotiations on the fiscal cliff and on the grand bargain.
Oh, my. So if they can, you know, death by a thousand paper cuts, in other words, is
yes.
the strategy to take down Obamacare.
Yes.
Just like they've been, you know, they've been actually doing to Social Security all these years, the cost of living benefits, or, you know, they don't really follow inflation like they should. Just like they've done with unemployment insurance last year, they cut it from 99 weeks down to 74 weeks. I mean, it's this death by a thousand paper cuts strategy that the Republicans have for any program that helps anybody except the billionaires.
I think it's going to be along those lines. Along the lines also of what some are saying is a strategy to make it fail by Republican governors refusing to set up state exchanges, forcing the government, the federal government, to set up exchanges,
right.
Which is going to make it more difficult for the federal government.
Right. Although it won't be all that more difficult because they have one bureaucracy, basically. They're not going to have to clone it over and over
right.
for every state. I just find it incredibly ironic that these Republican governors are saying, we hate the federal takeover of health care. But by the way, in our state, we're not going to run our own health care program. Please, federal government, come in and do it for us.
Yeah, I thought they were Tenth Amendment guys.
Absolutely bizarre.
Also, a new Jimi Hendrix album is coming out on March the 5th.
Yeah, they found an old master, an old set of tapes?
Yes, People, Hell, and Angels contains 12 previously unreleased tracks recorded in 1968 and 69.
Wow.
These are songs he recorded apart from the Jimi Hendrix experience, as he considered new experimental directions for his follow-up to Electric Ladyland. He plays keyboards, percussion, and a second guitar on the album.
And that's being released when?
March the 5th.
Okay, I'll be looking for that. Jimi Hendrix was an absolute musical genius.
Genius.
And his loss made the world a little dimmer place, or a little quieter place, anyway.
That's big news.
Indeed. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, and free-don.org. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
And happy Thanksgiving to you
happy
and yours.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
I'm just checking out some of the latest news over at the Center for American Progress. It's thinkprogress.org blog. Fox Pundit jokes that food stamps could be a diet plan. This is you've got the audio of that? Oh, yeah. It's amazing. Anyhow, an incredible opportunity is coming for America, in my humble opinion, starting in just a couple of weeks. The Bush tax cuts are going to expire. Pentagon spending is going to be slashed, although still hugely larger than just a decade ago it will be. And to make conservatives smile, funding for programs that keep poor and unemployed people alive and healthy are going to be cut. Now, this is an opportunity for several reasons. First, when the Bush tax cuts expire at the end of the year, everybody's taxes are going to go up. I'm going to sneeze here. Excuse me. Particularly taxes on the rich and the very rich. Which means that if Democrats propose cutting taxes on working class people while ignoring the new rates for the rich, after the first of the year,
Republicans can sign on and vote for the legislation without violating their blood oath, the multimillionaire K Street lobbyist Grover Norquist. Well, you know, it goes nowhere as far as it should, which would be to roll back the Reagan tax cuts. It's a start on moving America in a more egalitarian direction. Second, most of the cuts, this is the sequestration stuff that happens at the end of the year, right? Most of those cuts to the Pentagon budget are good things. The Pentagon has lost over $2 trillion they can't account for. It's a good guess you'll find a lot of it in the 20-bedroom mansions owned by defense contractors and lobbyists that ring the Washington, D.C. suburbs. And this nation needs a healthy and robust debate on our role as empire. And President Obama said this during the campaign. It's time to do some nation building right here at home. And third, by breaking out the social spending cuts and requiring Republicans, particularly in the House of Representatives, which they control, to go on record on their position on cuts for social services, the American people will get to see up front and personal Paul Ryan's and Mitt Romney's 47% are moochers philosophy played out large. Americans will see in a way that's absolutely irrefutable that the Republican Party is only out for the interests of the top 1% and doesn't give a rat's patootie about working people or the poor. That could also, keep in mind, the Democrats got 500,000 more votes for the House of Representatives this year than Republicans did, and yet Republicans control the House because of gerrymandering. But if you expose enough Republicans as wackadoodle right-wing crazies who basically hate working people, elderly, the poor, whatever, and are only carrying water for the very, very rich, that could set the stage for a Democratic victory in the House of Representatives in 2 years. Because every 2 years, 100%, all 435, every single member of the House of Representatives is up for re-election every 2 years. So to make the most of this opportunity, Democrats need to have legislation in place now, this week or next, that addresses these three issues. In my opinion, it should be three separate bills that will break out each of the issues. First, cuts taxes on middle and lower income people, while leaving rich people's taxes the same as they were during the Clinton years. The second ratifies cuts to the Pentagon budget, but in a way that's rational and reflects the reality that our biggest current and future threats are not nuclear war, but cyber war. Not so much nation states as non-state actors angry that our drones kill their families. The legislation should, incidentally, put some serious limits on presidential power to be judge, jury, and executioner via drone strikes, particularly when the target is an American citizen, but frankly, I'd say for any human being. If the Democrats put this legislation on the table now, with the promise of a vote on it the week after the new year, it would soothe the fears of those who believe in the uncertainty fairy. And if it's decent legislation, it'll give progressives a rallying point to pressure their members of Congress, which, frankly, I'd much rather see a rollback of the incredibly destructive Reagan tax cuts. But this, at least, would be a start. It would calm the hysteria. I mean, it would make the Republicans hysterical, but everybody else, you know. It would provide a basis for moving forward. It would put the lie to the stupid Republican theory that it's good for our economy when the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. If you combine all of this with some reasonable trade policies like those advanced by Senators Sherrod Brown and Bernie Sanders, we could even see a return to the Eisenhower and Clinton prosperities. So everybody's all hysterical about this so-called fiscal cliff, a phrase that Ben Bernanke coined. I think it's time to drive off the so-called fiscal cliff. Once done, Americans are going to realize, first, it's nothing but a speed bump. It's just a speed bump. And this whole Thelma and Louise thing, this hysteria that's being hyped by the so-called deficit hawks, oh my God, we're going to go off the edge down into the Grand Canyon, we're all going to die, oh no. No. We can fix this. And let the new Congress do it. With more Democrats in the House of Representatives and some good ones. You know, let Alan Grayson loose on them. And in the Senate, some brilliant Democrats in the Senate. Let Tammy Baldwin after them. Let Elizabeth Warren after them. We can do this. We can do it quickly. I mean, John Boehner's going to have to be dragged to the table kicking and screaming. which is going to be a challenge because Eric Cantor is always standing right behind him with that knife in his, you know, poking his kidney. But, yeah, that shiv. But it could be done. So that's my take on this. You know, if everybody's hysterical about the fiscal cliff, I'm like, you know, it's a bungee cord. It's an off ramp for craziness. Jerry in Chicago. Hey, Jerry, what's on your mind today?
Hey, I'm grateful for the Freedom of Information Act.
Okay.
Freedom of Information Act.
Oh, FOIA. Yeah, the ability to sue the government and say, let me see. Yeah, in fact, it should be expanded. I'm with you.
And I wanted to talk about documents that were released in 1995 by the government on Pearl Harbor.
Okay.
They released a huge trove of documents which establish in really exhaustive detail that the Office of Naval Intelligence knew about the coming attack and had, in fact, facilitated the attack. That the Office of Naval Intelligence, 14 months before Pearl Harbor, prepared an action proposal outlining 8 steps to provoke a Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor.
This has been a Republican theory for a long, long time. And, you know, when FDR ordered that the Straits of Malacca be barricaded, this is the area in the ocean between between Indonesia and Malaysia, or between Indonesia and Java, I guess would be the island. It was the principal shipping line for oil from the Middle East to Japan. When he ordered that that be blockaded, I think it was fairly predictable that the Japanese would lash out in response to that. But one of the guys in the Office of Naval Intelligence who was in charge of this stuff was Dean Rusk. And we interviewed Dean Rusk before he died. And he was quite clear that they were tracking half of the Japanese fleet. It had split in half. They were tracking half of it. I forget whether it was the northern or the southern half. And the other half, they didn't know where it had gone. And it wasn't until Pearl Harbor that they discovered where it was, much to their horror.
No. The documents that our own government has released
prove
that we knew where that fleet was, that we tracked it from the Kurils all the way to the staging point for the attack.
Yeah. I'd have to see those. Do you think that the president knew about this?
Absolutely. So there's a list of 36 people that have been declassified who were involved in this decision-making process.
Okay. Jerry, I'm going to have to track this down because that conflicts with what one of the guys who was there told me. They actually told Lamar, my research partner. But you know, we have it on tape. I'm going to have to look it up. Thanks a lot, Jerry. 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It is interesting, though, that it was Republicans in 1941 who were saying the U.S. should not go to war against Hitler, and it took Pearl Harbor to make it happen.
This really might be the best Thanksgiving ever.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back to Talk Media for the sane among us. Chris in Littleton, Colorado, listening on AM 760 and out of Denver. Hey, Chris, what's on your mind today? The original Thanksgiving?
Hey, I was doing a little bit of research on Thanksgiving, and I know that it was sort of slipping your mind, the actual historical tribe. I may be butchering the name, but Wampanoag?
Yeah, the Wampanoag. Yeah.
Right. Apparently that wasn't the real Thanksgiving. I did a little bit of research, and apparently the real Thanksgiving started as Governor William Bradford designated, quote, a day for Thanksgiving kept in all the churches for our victories against the Pequots. Am I saying that right?
Yeah, the Pequot Indians, yeah.
Right, the Pequot Massacre. And actually, I believe the first Thanksgiving wasn't until about March, and this modern incarnation of Thanksgiving at the beginning of winter was actually the celebration of the ethnic cleansing of something like 800 different Indians, and apparently there a bunch of Indians gather right around Thanksgiving called the National Day of Mourning at Plymouth Rock. Have you heard of this?
Yes, I have, and you're right. And there's, and in fact, in my book, Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, I've got, which I can't put my hands on quickly so I could read it to you, but there's a rather lengthy quote in there where I believe it was Bradford was talking about the Pequot slaughter and, you know, how they had made allies. It wasn't the Wampogs, it was another tribe, but they had made allies of this tribe, and they surrounded the Pequot village and set it on fire and just shot everybody who came running out, old, young, male, female, didn't matter. And the Indians that they had made allies with, the Pilgrims, were so horrified by this that they just refused to participate any further. And Bradford, or whoever it was at the time, my recollection is that it was William Bradford, ridiculed them for not having courage. And there's this incredible quote by him that's in Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, where he says, and he's talking about the smell of burning flesh. And he said, you know, the great is the Lord for this smell that wafted into our nostrils.
While I got you on the line, I've been trying to get in for a while. I was going to ask you were talking about you're thankful for your, you know, how basically the gift of life, and how you wish that your parents could, you know, basically come up and just like look at the sky, what they'd give. I remember earlier in the year, you were talking about how you had like an NDE in your surgery. Was that,
pretty
powerful to you? I mean, what are your thoughts on the afterlife is what I wanted to get.
Okay. Yeah. I didn't have a near death experience. I after my surgery, I was leaking inside, and my stomach filled up with urine without my knowing, and I couldn't figure out why I felt like I was dying. And I ended up, you know, going to the ER, and they said, you know, you're dying. You know, like your internal organs are shutting down because there's not supposed to be urine in your gut. And so this was after prostate surgery. So I ended, you know, and my doctor was on vacation for a couple of weeks, and so he wasn't around. So they basically just kind of drained me and loaded me on drugs. And during that time, when I was just really, really, really sick, my mom came and visited me in the hospital bed, you know, and it was just it was a very emotional, it was so real. I mean, it was all I could talk to Louise about after, you know, a few hours later when she showed up.
Do you think that's something of the paranormal? I mean,
I don't know. I mean, it may have been the spirit of my mom coming to visit me, or it might have been something that my mind manufactured. I don't really care. It to me, it was real, and so I'm choosing to experience it as real. And I, you know, my personal belief on what happens when we go is that we become part of the light that is everything, you know, the consciousness that is everything. I think that we just merge into this great field of light and bliss. But, you know, I'm willing to be surprised. it's going to happen someday. So, anyhow, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Fred in Woodruff, Wisconsin. Hey, Fred, you have a wife named Louise, and today's her birthday. Happy birthday to Louise.
Yeah, she's listening downstairs. Yeah, we've been together 45 years. Just
oh, that's marvelous.
Years.
You got 5 years on us.
I know you've got a daughter that went into that.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that's what I'm thankful for. But I'd like to reframe the Great Republican Financial Cliff.
Yes, sir.
I'd like to reframe it as a Great Republican Financial Bluff.
Yes, it is.
Means to deceive or to mislead.
Yeah, in fact, it's an opportunity for the Democrats if they will take it. If they do what I suggested, if they break this into three pieces and say, okay, we're going to deal with the Defense Department part, we're going to deal with the social spending part, and we're going to deal with the tax part in three separate phases so that all of America can see what we're doing rather than doing some kind of grand bargain where there's all this stuff is cloaked in mysticism and opacity. Instead, just say, you know, here's what we're doing. It's totally transparent. You can see what's going on, and you can see the way that people vote on it. I think it's just a tremendous opportunity for the Democratic Party. Fred, thank you for the call. Thanks for pointing that out, and happy birthday to Louise.
Thank you, too,
okay.
Tom.
Good to hear from you. John in Folsom, California. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I'm thankful for the Obama reelection.
Me too.
I'm also thankful for Obamacare.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
And I would like it to be taken a step further and get to the single-payer health care system that,
you know, last night,
the world seems to
last night on our TV show, I interviewed a guy from Cook County, in Cook County, you know, in the Chicago area in Illinois, and they got a waiver from the state, and they're going full bore Obamacare a year early with Medicare money, and Medicaid money rather, which is how it's supposed to work. And they're providing health care to all these people. And it suddenly struck me as I was talking to this guy, Medicaid is a single-payer health care system, basically. Obamacare has kind of a backdoor single-payer piece to it that's huge. And Cook County is stepping forward with this. Good on them for that. So So.
Well, absolutely. But I would like people to think about the burden, the financial burden that would be lifted from the small and medium-sized companies mm-hmm. for health care if there was a universal single-payer system.
Yes.
And how that would spur the economy and put yep. people back to work.
Yeah, it would definitely spur the economy.
I've talked to union leaders about this, and they are all for it. They say their corporations that they represent the workers for, that would just reduce the company cost on benefits dramatically.
Everybody wins, John, with a national single-payer health care system, except the for-profit insurance companies that pay their CEOs $1 billion. And those companies, in my opinion, do not deserve to exist. Thank you, John.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Tomorrow is Thanksgiving. What are you thankful for? I'm actually thankful for a few sane Republicans. It's the good, the bad, and the very, very dichophobically ugly. The good. Harvard University students, following in the footsteps of Unity College in Maine, Harvard students voted last week for their school to completely divest itself of more than $30 billion in endowment funds from the fossil fuel industry. 72% of voting students supported the move to divest. As the co-coordinator of the campaign, Chloe Mammon, said about the vote, in 1990, 52% of voting students supported complete divestment from apartheid South Africa. Today, 72% of voting students are raising their voices for fossil divestment, telling Harvard to stop investing in companies that are threatening our future, end quote. More than 50 universities are working to do the exact same thing. Well done. The bad. Former Romney advisor Dan Senior. We've heard a lot of excuses from Republicans over why Romney lost the election, and none of them address the candidate himself or the Republican Party's radical positions. Senior's excuse doesn't either. On MSNBC today, Senior blamed Romney's loss on, get this, polling. He claimed the campaign received bad data from right-of-center polling, which led the campaign to focus on the wrong areas to get out the vote. Of course, had the Romney team just bothered to check Nate Silver's polling data based on arithmetic and published in the New York Times, they would have known that they had a heck of a lot of work to do to appeal to voters. But blaming polling for why Romney got trounced among women, young people, and minorities ignores the real reason Romney lost. He ran a campaign that only appealed to the top 1%. And the very, very ugly Fox so-called news talking head Andrea Tentaros. Yesterday, we mentioned how Newark Mayor Cory Booker put out a challenge to live on food stamps for a week to raise awareness about the struggle of impoverished Americans. Well, in Fox Business today, Tentaros gladly accepted Booker's offer. When she was asked how she might live on $133 a month for food, Tentaros responded, quote, "I should try it because do you know how fabulous I'd look? I'd be so skinny. I mean, the camera adds 10 pounds. It really does. I'd be looking great," end quote. So rather than commiserating with Americans who can't get enough to eat in the wealthiest nation on the planet, Tentaros devolved into a petty rant about her own vanity. Well, really, should we have expected anything different over at Fox so-called News? That's very, very ugly. It's incredibly ugly. Oh, I got to stop saying that all the time. Okay, hey, Merwina, am I saying that right?
Hi.
Manchester Township, New Jersey?
Right. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Thanks for calling.
You were talking earlier about blue laws.
Yes.
I've lived under blue laws.
Mm-hmm.
I was in Kansas City, Missouri under blue laws.
Uh-huh.
You could not buy baby bottles. That was back when they broke.
Mm-hmm.
You could not buy a baby bottle, toilet paper, soap, groceries, non-prescription drugs, gasoline. I mean, there was just a long list of things you couldn't do on Sunday.
Right.
What you could do if you had a car was drive across to the Kansas side and buy whatever you want except for alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
We lived with that for years and years, and it was a grind. A lot of people, especially poorer people who didn't have a car to drive to Kansas or who worked all week and needed to do their shopping on Sunday afternoon.
Right.
Couldn't do it. It was really a pain in the Okole how.
Yeah, yeah. Well, or you just plan around it. I mean, when we lived in Germany, we would just make sure that we did all our shopping before the weekend.
You can do that if you're not working while the stores are open.
Yeah.
And,
well, that's the other thing. If you lived in Germany, you didn't work more than a 40-hour week.
Back in those days, a six-day week for poorer people was kind of common.
It was pretty normal, yeah. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah,
we're not, even though we're the richest nation in the world, most of that riches, I mean, 41% of all the wealth in this country is held by five people who are members of the Walton family. It's really pretty amazing when you think of it. Well, I want to thank you for...
If you lived on the Kansas side, or, you know, that's the other thing, too, was the city was bleeding money from the sales tax that went to the Kansas side.
Right.
Instead of our side. They only bled a little bit because they didn't have liquor by the drink, so you had to come to the Missouri side if you wanted to go clubbing.
There you go. Merwina, thank you for sharing that your blue law experience with us. I've got an app on my phone of weird laws. In Alabama, it's illegal to howl at ladies within the city limits. In Alabama, boogers may not be flipped into the wind. In Alabama, bear wrestling matches are prohibited. In Wyoming, it is illegal for women to stand within 5 feet of a bar while drinking. In Wyoming, you may not take a picture of a rabbit from January to April without an official permit. Using a firearm to fish is strictly forbidden in Wyoming. So anyway, all right. Luis is enough already. You got it. Paul in Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Happy Thanksgiving, Tom.
Thank you, and the same to you.
Actually, we lived under blue laws when probably the both of us lived back in Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
I remember the weirdest one. I remember not being able to buy alcohol on Sunday, or especially on Christmas, we couldn't. It was a great consternation to my older brother at one time. But in 1974, I belonged to a big band jazz ensemble through one of the music camps, and we went on a Sunday to play a concert at a little town called Fremont, Michigan. We were at the high school,
mm-hmm.
and some lady came in and interrupted the show and started screaming at us and saying it was illegal to play jazz on Sunday. So.
Whoa. Well, here, yeah. I looked up Michigan. In Detroit, it's illegal to ogle a woman from a moving car. In Michigan, it's against the law to serenade your girlfriend. Michigan only has a few of these. Dentists are considered mechanics.
Of course, there's that thing about cuffing a couple years ago.
Yeah.
West Branch?
Yeah, and in Massachusetts, snoring is prohibited unless all the bedroom windows are closed and securely locked. So it gets strange.
Hey, I wanted to talk about, as you are always writing a book, I'm always putting myself through some sort of reading course, and I'm studying medieval history right now, and I thought I'd talk a little bit about what we can thankfully be thankful about having on our table now that we didn't have before.
Mm-hmm.
But first I wanted to say also the history of unions actually goes back to medieval times and
sure.
the artisan guilds. Trade guilds.
Yep.
Right?
Yes. The masons were the first big one. They were the stonemasons. They built the buildings.
And the guilds even go back further.
The musicians.
To the Roman times when one of the emperors, I think it was Diocletian, ordered that, you know, there's the familial, I do what my father does, my son will do whatever profession trade I do.
Mm.
That goes back to Roman times. So when the conservative right-wingers say that they're conservative, they're really not. They're not for anything they don't have any history. They're just a bunch of neo-capitalists. So.
Yes.
Anyway, what we have on our table that we didn't have in those times was no corn, no tomatoes, or sugar or coffee.
Right. Corn and tomatoes were unique to North America. Sugar was the Caribbean islands, was it not?
Right.
And coffee came
in Europe.
And coffee came out of India, didn't it?
Right. And in Europe, and so what we mean by medieval, actually.
Or actually, coffee came out of Africa. The first coffee was from Ethiopia. I remember that because we've actually bought that Ethiopian coffee, which is the original, the mother of all coffees. And boy, does it kick your butt. It is strong stuff.
Two phrases that we hear sometimes that actually apply to class. One, I didn't know this one, below the salt.
Mm-hmm.
In the dining halls of the medieval times when all of the classes dined together from the lord and lady, all the way down to the peasants, the tables were set up, these trestle tables were set up just basically like plywood or doors or something on sawhorses. and the Lord and Lady were up on kind of a riser, and salt was a valuable commodity. It was set on the tables, but not for the peasants.
Hmm.
So they were said to be dining below the salt.
Oh, very interesting.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
Another one was has to do with the phrase the upper crust. When they ate white bread was they had all kinds of dark bread and stuff that was very fibrous, but white bread was finely milled flour and it was very expensive.
It was the elegant stuff, yeah.
Yeah, and so when they had that at the table, of course that was also at the head of the table, and usually it was some honored guest or a noble who got to have the first crack at it, at the crust, and that was where we got the phrase the upper crust.
Upper crust, amazing. Paul, I got to move along. I got a board full of calls, but thank you for that, for the call. Thank you for the Thanksgiving wishes and for some fascinating trivia. Jeff in Denver. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hey, well, first I'm thankful that you and Louise are doing well right now. And
thank you, me too.
Also very thankful for the voice that you've given people like me over the years and people like Roy from Rio Rancho, who I'd love to honor this day.
Yes, Roy has passed on this last year, and we all miss him.
Yes. But he affected people like me. You are very thankful that you gave a voice to Roy.
Yeah.
Anyway, as far as the Sabbath is concerned or a day of rest, I think that there's almost nothing more important that we neglect. But I have a proposal that can save us money, save us incredible amounts of energy, and give us that day of rest. If we go to a 4-day work week where we stagger the weeks, where you work Monday through Thursday 1 week, the next week you work Tuesday through Friday.
Right.
You end up with 26 4-day weekends a year, so 26 mini vacations each year.
Right.
You save 20% of your commuting energy, you save 20% of your commuting time and money.
Right.
And so we save incredible amounts of energy and we get lots of time to rest and we still work hard.
Right, and this takes us back to that that article that was the I think it was a cover story in Time magazine back in, as I recall, 67 about the coming leisure society. They pointed out that as mechanization and computers and whatnot, as the productivity of individual workers increases, if their wages increase along with that productivity, then by the year 2000, people will be working less than a 30-hour week for the exact same pay that they were working for a 40-hour week back in the 60s. And had the top 1% not taken all that money, that's where we would be right now. Well said, Jeff. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I'm thankful to Jeff in Denver. He's taught me a lot over the years. And to all of you. We'll be back.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming.
One can hope. Doug in Hudson, Florida. Hey, Doug, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, long-time listener, first-time caller. I always appreciate your point of view on everything. I just wanted to touch base. I'm on my way home now from work, and I hadn't been listening until just now, and didn't know if you touched on too many of us that have to work tomorrow at these corporations that are people that are heartless people and make people, come into work on selling cheap Chinese junk on Thursday, Thanksgiving.
Yeah, in fact, a good part of the show has been devoted to a discussion between me and our listeners about whether we should follow the lead of three states and have bring back the old blue laws that say on Thanksgiving Day you can't run a retail operation unless it's essential services. I'm inclined to say yes. Then I would add to that, there are, a lot of people who are going to have to work on Thursday, on Thanksgiving Day, the people who flight attendants and pilots and airlines and cab drivers and police officers,
they should
all get extra pay for working on Thanksgiving Day. I mean, that should be at law.
Yeah, I mean, in my position in particular, I would be paid. I don't have to work, luckily, because I'm a member of management and they would have to pay me too much money. But, all my underlings that work for minimum wage, are required to report, and of course our company happens to be owned by a company with the initials BC.
Mm.
So, I find it to be, heartless
So this company is not paying time and a half for holiday work?
Not for the part-timers, no.
Yeah.
That's
sad. Not from what I understand. I mean, it doesn't apply to me, but that's the reason why they won't have me there, and that's fine. I'm not happy to have the day off with my family. I just feel bad that other people have to endure when I believe that they would make that same amount of money, you know, the next day or in the next coming days. There's no reason to take that away. At Radio Shack a couple years ago when I was a manager there, they opened on Easter, and I just was kind of blown away with the fact that, what do they think, Jesus Christ is only good for one holiday? You can't have two? I mean...
Thanksgiving in particular, I can get it being open on a religious holiday, but being open on a national secular holiday, that one, and Thanksgiving, I think, is the highest and holiest of the national secular holidays. We've reinvented a whole new mythology around it. And we should do something about that. Doug, thank you for the call. I'm with you. Kathy in Detroit. Hey, Kathy, what's up?
Yeah, hi. I've been a long-time Democrat, lifelong Democrat, my family and everybody. And I've got a lot of family all across the country. I've been following this Agenda 21. And it's interesting because the more I checked into it, and including the San Francisco City Councilwoman, I can't think of her name right now. She is on the City Council. Her name escapes me at the moment. She's a very liberal Democrat. And the more she began to read up on this, she said, in fact, they interviewed her in San Francisco there on TV.
Mm-hmm.
And
on Fox News.
This is a very evil, evil plot.
Yeah, it's not.
I thought, well.
Kathy, let me reassure you. You can go onto the United Nations website and you can read it.
Yeah, I did.
It's nothing but guidelines for a sustainable lifestyle.
In Detroit, there's a number of Democrats from the Detroit area, also up in the Upper Peninsula and Lower Michigan area, that this is not just Republican, but there's many Democrats that are speaking.
No, Kathy, I understand. There are Democrats who listen to Fox News and who buy this wackadoodle nonsense. But there is nothing to be afraid of with Agenda 21. Agenda 21, it was an agenda item in a meeting that the UN had about climate change and how communities can function in ways that use less carbon and are better for human beings. And it is not mandatory. It is guidelines. And it is not law. There is no law. The UN has no enforcement mechanism. Fox News and Glenn Beck has a novel out about this. Novel. NOVEL. It means fiction. It's made up. And people are thinking that this stuff is real. And whether they're Democrats or Republicans doesn't matter. If you think that Agenda 21 is real and it represents a threat to you, A, you're watching Fox News way too much. And B, you need to go to the UN website and read Agenda 21. It's right there. You can Google it very easily. And in fact, I have it right here in front of me, or I had it. Where did it go? Here it is right here. International cooperation to accelerate sustainable development in developing countries. First of all, we're not a developing country. Number two, combating poverty. Oh, my God, we can't have that, can we? Bill O'Reilly might have to pay higher taxes. Changing consumption patterns. It's, observing how consumption patterns are changing. Demographic dynamics and sustainability. Protecting and promoting human health conditions. That could mean national single-payer health care system or something like that. Promoting indeed. Be afraid. Be very afraid. Promoting sustainable human settlement development. In other words, having cities like Portland, Oregon, where you actually have bike paths and greenways and things like that. Rather than just, unrestrained development like Anchorage, Alaska, where, it's miles and miles of sprawl. This is just simple common sense stuff. And like I said, it's not law. The UN does not make law for the United States. The UN, for the world, for all the countries of the world, the UN is saying, okay, y'all asked us what's the best way as cities develop, as countries develop. And this is for developing nations, by the way, not for countries like the United States. How do you do it? Here's some suggestions. So if you're hysterical about Agenda 21, stop watching Fox News. Seriously, because your mind has been poisoned. Coming up next to the Tom Harbin program, it's our special Conversations with Great Minds interview with economist and author Professor Richard Wolff. I'll share my thoughts on the so-called fiscal cliff And thank to you for listening and supporting our program. And to all of you, we wish you a very happy Thanksgiving holiday weekend from all of us here at the Tom Hartman Program. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it. Seal it.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.